In 1996, political consultant James Carville wrote, "We're Right, They're Wrong." It became a number one New York Times bestseller, and Bill Clinton credited it for his reelection. Now, 20 years later, and in the middle of another political campaign, Mr. Carville has updated the book, calling it, "We're Still Right, They're Still Wrong, The Democrats' Case for 2016. It's published by Blue Rider Press, which is an imprint of Random House, Penguin Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought James Carville back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Love being here.
The original title, "We're Right, They're Wrong," is actually a quote from Harry Truman. What was the occasion when he said it?
He also said, "I vote the man, not the party. It's always the Democrat." And we had dug it up from Truman. It's been 20 years ago, so I forgot
you
the
forgot.
Exact context.
You say that you've never converted a single Republican. So whom have you updated this book for? Do you think that a Trump supporter will even be mildly swayed by any of these arguments?
No, I don't think a Trump supporter is going to read it. I don't think they're very interested in being swayed. I picked up the book and I just started looking through it, and this was when, obviously, the book was published in 96, but the idea started in, after the election, 1994. And it was just to kind of rally the Democrats because we were completely decimated in that off-year congressional election. And I went back and I looked at it, and I looked at updated statistics, and I said, oh, my God, we're not just right. I mean, we're really right. I mean, everything has turned out to be even a bigger case. So, I'd be delighted if a Trump supporter read this, but I doubt that they will. But to Democrats out there who think that we've been right, my answer is you have no idea of how right we've been.
You open with a story about Richard Mueller. Can you tell us about him? He's a conservative?
Right. He's certainly not political. He's a physicist at the University of California, Berkeley. And Mueller said that he thought that there were reasons to be a climate skeptic, that he thought they wasn't taking the temperatures right and the equipment was outdated and they were putting it in, shopping on asphalt. And he had a lot of reasons. And he said, look, I'm going to go raise some money and do my own research. So he went out, he raised money, a lot of it from Koch Brothers, I think a lot of it from Exxon, other oil companies. And he sat, he got his daughter, and he started something called a Berkeley Earth Surface Temperature. And he had a guy named Perlmutter, who was a Nobel Prize winner. He had some other people. And he studied it for a year and a half with 1.6 billion data points. And the anti-climate people were very excited. And the Wall Street Journal said, look, we'll let you use our op-ed to publish your first cut of your return. So he says, I've studied this. I had good reason to. We did 1.6 billion data points. And guess what? They're right. The Earth is getting warmer.
So the Kochs and other conservatives who initially backed his research wouldn't accept his conclusions.
Right. And then they said, well, he just said Earth. And then he came back and he said, yeah, well, I've been researching. It's also ocean temperatures. And he said, well, he didn't say why. And he said, well, actually, I did that research. And the only thing that makes any sense is that it's carbon emissions. And the point I'm sort of making in the book is if 1.6 billion data points does not convince anybody, you're not very likely to get Uncle Harry at the Thanksgiving table. I mean, it's just people are oblivious to it. But I like the backstory of a guy that just went out on his own, raised the money, did it, and just printed his conclusion.
Do you think Donald Trump really believes that climate change is a Chinese hoax?
I don't think he's read I don't think he's read a single thing about it. And I think he just, I doubt if he believes it or doesn't believe it. It just sounds like something clever to say.
But James Inhofe surely has read about it. He's the senator from Oklahoma, right. The chairman of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Public Works. And he attempted to refute evidence of climate change by bringing a snowball to the Senate floor.
Yeah, we made that point, and then the title was 1.6 billion data points versus a single snowball. And it's just one of those things, at the end of the day, it's so evident, and we're so right about this. And I think it's just going to take a time for it to just have to unwind. Max Planck famously said that science does not triumph because it convinces its opponents. Science triumphs because its opponents eventually die. Science advances one funeral at a time. And these people at the Trump rally, Dr. Mueller or James Carville are 1,000 scientists with 1,000 peer-reviewed papers are not going to convince them. I hate to say that. I used to think that there was one talking point. If you had it, you could convince people. But I've now concluded that you just have to wait.
But how do you get things done if you can't get other members of Congress to go along? I was thinking about what's happening with the Zika virus now, and I was wondering how many Florida representatives voted to fund the research and the fighting of Zika.
Look,
because that went down in flames as well.
It did, and they attached riders to it. It was inadequate. You know, as long as the kind of view is Zika is affecting people not like us, and, you know, it seems removed from some people, and you can't, I mean, ask me why, I can't delve into that mind. I can't delve into the mind of somebody that just denies it. I think it's a cultural thing. It's like people who say they don't believe in evolution. I don't know if they really don't believe it. They just don't like the people who are telling them that evolution is real.
Well, do you think that it also has to do with the fact that many of the opponents, many of the deniers are paid a lot of money?
I think it has something to do with that. One of the things I talked about in the book was the Ebola virus. And I'll never forget this. I'm teaching a class at Tulane. I'm flying back, overnight flight from Latin America, and I'm reading an article, and it quotes a microbiologist at Tulane, a guy named Dr. Richard Gary. He was being an expert. So I called him and I said, would you come over and talk to my class? So I had my class in my house in New Orleans. Like it was a seminar with like 15 students. And he was sitting there in a circle and he said, I just got back from Africa. And this was in October in the middle of it. I said, wait a minute, am I exposing, you know? And he said, no, there's no way it's not going to spread. It never will spread in a first world country. And he went into a detailed explanation. I talked about the Ebola virus, of which there was no way that this virus was going to break out in the general public. Every health expert imaginable knew that. And they kept running these crazy stories that all went away the day after the election. And even, you know, the better newspapers and the better news outlets got completely wrapped up in this insane narrative that every scientist, every person that knew anything, knew that it wasn't going to be transmitted.
But this wasn't just a partisan thing. You are critical of New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo for the way he responded.
I'm critical, but once people were caught up in the craze, then, I you know, to some extent it was disavowed. But yeah, the whole country just went on a stampede of something that no expert thought there was anything but the most remote chance that it ever be, not just a problem in the United States, but in any developed country. And then you had people like Bill O'Reilly calling for an end of all flights. There were no flights. I mean, it was one of these things where people going on. And Governor Cuomo, I'm sure his health people were telling him this is not it. But, you know, and so it then becomes where people say, well, if people feel insecure, then they must be insecure.
If you don't recognize that voice, it's James Carville. And his latest book is We're Still Right, They're Still Wrong. How do you explain to your political science students at Tulane University the phenomenon of Donald Trump?
There are a group, but the way that we start every premise, there's no public policy that is all good or all bad. Everything, if we pitch things in Apple, you know, it, like the apocalypse, if it's not now, when, it's all this. The best example I give them of a public policy that is most all good is taking lead out of paint. But somebody mined lead, somebody sold it, somebody brokered it, somebody commoditized it, somebody traded it, somebody transported it. It was some downside to it. And so Trump is, if you're 55 years old, you didn't go to college, by and large, you've had a difficult life. You've changed jobs any number of times. You probably almost lost your house in a financial crisis. You've probably been married 3 or 4 times. And Trump has an explanation. What happened to you is not that you had the wrong skill set for the economy you grew up in. It's that stupid politicians and immigrants did you in. And there was a magical country that you thought you were going to live in that I can take you back to. And that has appeal to a certain demographic, and they're not interested in my facts or economist facts or Richard Mueller or anybody else. Trump is saying the Chinese, you know, talked us into this global warming stuff just to create more things for themselves, and the Mexicans are flooding the country, and that is why you didn't make a bad career choice. You've been done in.
Well, you said that taking lead out of paint is one of those regulations that works, but there's such resistance to deregulation. I mean, to regulation. Did Tom Tillis, a Republican senator from North Carolina, say there was no need for Starbucks to require their employees to wash their hands after they used the bathroom?
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I probably could have gone into it a little bit deeper. There are studies that show that the EPA has produced X millions of dollars in health care savings. But every – we talked about this in the part about Dodd-Frank. Yes, if you have some more stringent rules on loans, some people are not going to be able to get a loan. Some institutions are going to stop that. But that's an outgrowth of what we saw in the financial crisis. Then we quoted Adam Smith, who said that, yeah, some regulations on finance are an imposition of liberty, but so is a firewall. I mean, there's certain, no one would say I can build my house if I'm in an apartment in New York. I'm going to build an apartment building and I'm not going to have a firewall between that and my neighbor. Well, no, you can't do that. Now, that is an imposition on your liberty. If you live in a rural, where I grew up in rural South Louisiana, you had the perk there, the place that you just couldn't throw your sewage in a ditch. Now, that to some extent, that's an imposition of liberty. It cost you something, but it's things that we understand. And I was... Think of this. I was coming down 7th Avenue and noticed the number of businesses, small businesses on one block. I was saying, well, there's a deli, a dry cleaner, a storage place, a dress shop. I couldn't think of a more regulated place to open a business than the island of Manhattan. The permits you have to get to deal with the city, the God knows what you have to do. And I couldn't think of a place that I've ever been in the world that had more diversity and more small businesses on one block. And obviously, somebody's making a living, because I was just on my way here. I was just noticing all of that.
Well, getting back to Tom Tillis, he didn't want the imposition of employees having to wash their hands. Aren't conservatives also affected by dirty hands? Don't they get just as sick?
But that's why we put it in the book. And what the libertarians say, that if a 9-year-old wants to drive, who are we to tell him that he can't drive? Or if somebody wants to fly, just so that we know that the pilot of the airplane, why have an FAA? Because, a guy's got to pass a test, he has to take a physical, or she has to, land a plane, she has to have X number of hours before you get on the plane. There are all kinds of things that we accept overwhelmingly. And the regulation that someone washed their hands, most of the people listening to the show, is a no-brainer. Tillis was saying, as long as you know that they don't have to wash their hands, you can make an informed decision as to whether or not. Now, how are you going to know if they wash their hands or not? All right. Until somebody gets sick. And there's actually a little bit, I was reading an interesting thing, and somebody said it's one of these things that makes sense. They should have hand washing in public so people would know when you come out, because it's one of those things that you almost shame people into doing it.
You explain how giving control over environmental policy to the states often leads to situations like the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. Why are states less effective than the federal government regarding those kinds of issues?
Well, if they have 50 different states, and a lot of states like Louisiana, it's been said, and I think unfortunately it's my home state, that the flag of Texaco flies over the state capitol. And if you when a state is as dependent on an industry as mine is on petroleum, natural gas, the influence that they have is inordinate to the number of people in the state. That happens over and over again. I mean, that was the kind of argument during the segregation thing. As well, the states can make the decision as to whether they should do that. And Hamilton is you know, the play that, you know, literally everybody in the world talked about, and Hamilton had thought about those things very deeply in the founding of the country. And, you know, and so, you know, you got to have standard, if you have standard water pipes, if you have standards as to the amount of lead that they can have in them, you have these kinds of things, that benefits us all. And, you know, some of it does tell the state that you have to pass certain minimum requirements, but that prevents what they did was cut the water off to try to save a buck in Flint and caused, you know, I don't know how long we're going to be dealing with the effects of that lead crisis.
What about the flooding in your state? I hope you escaped.
I did, but there's something that's very important to know
but
about
this
the
is also tied to climate change and legislation and regulations.
Look, first of all, we don't know if a specific event is tied to climate change, but we do know that we've had more extreme weather events, and so that's fair enough. The vast majority of the people that flooded in these rains in Louisiana did not live in a floodplain. They were certified by engineers to build where they built. In fact, even the private sector is going to take a big hit here. The mortgages, the people that held a mortgage, did not require that they had flood insurance. So they're gonna take a hit too. This was a 1 in 10,000 event. It had nothing to do with low lying areas or coastal erosion or many of the problems that we faced in Louisiana. This was a huge rainstorm. A town called Watson, which is right outside of Baton Rouge, got 32 inches of rain in 24 hours. There come some places. I bet you New York gets 45 inches of rain a year. But, you know, I don't know. I'm just guessing. Maybe less than that. I mean, it was.
Well, we get rain regularly, but
yeah, right. You get
once in a while. We get a Hurricane Sandy.
Right, but and this was a Hurricane Sandy, and this was not a place that was. People say, well, maybe they shouldn't do it in Louisiana. This could have happened anywhere that got that amount of rain.
My guest is James Carville, a political consultant, commentator, educator, actor, attorney, media personality, liberal pundit. It's being suggested by the Washington Post that he was mentioned as one of several people Hillary Clinton's allies are suggesting to play Donald Trump in debate prep sessions. And he'll probably draw upon his new book, if he ever does that, for some of the arguments. It's called We're Still Right, They're Still Wrong, The Democrats' Case for 2016, written with the help of Ryan Jacobs and published by, who's publishing
this?
Blue Rider, the Penguin.
Or Penguin Random House, yes, sir.
We'll continue a conversation after this. And we are back with James Carville, whose latest book is We're Still Right, They're Still Wrong, The Democrats' Case for 2016. The book was actually released in May.
It was written in May.
Written in May.
When we had to write it, so, we were saying when we write a book, we think Trump's going to be the nominee, but the lead time it takes in putting it together, publishing it, printing it, and everything else was now August.
So since then, have you found a way to answer what you call the billion-dollar question of this election? Why Trump and why now?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, we had talked about it a little bit earlier. I think the Republican Party had become really, really split. And Trump came in, and I knew he was dangerous. I have a place in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, which is closer to New Orleans. Actually, I bought it from Pete Fountain, a very great
clarinet player.
He just recently died. He's a great guy. And Trump had a rally in Gulfport, which is maybe 25 miles to the east of me. And I got in my pickup truck, and I just ran and put a cap on and, you know, put some sunglasses, and there had 25,000 people out there. And I said, oh, my God, somebody's going to vote for this guy. I can tell you that. And, again, his appeal was to people who felt like, I always got to get this a lot in Louisiana. He said, James, this is not the same country we grew up in. And my answer is, of course it's not. The country continually changes.
They all have cell phones.
Yeah, and it's different ethnic groups, different people. I mean, the country that I grew up in was not the same country that my grandfather grew up in. I mean, things change. And Trump is somehow or another promising people that we can go back to something grand.
Was that grand? Some people are saying it's a racist appeal.
Well, I think most people think it's some part of it is. I mean, you know, when you start talking about the president not being born here, it's pretty clear that there's something there. they believe if you are, you know, a plumber in South Mississippi, you know, you had everything your way, and then competition came in and foreign goods and help and efficiency and robots and, you know, God knows what not, lower wages, and you feel like, hey, my life is not what I expected it to be.
You quote Kevin Williamson, who was writing the National Review,
right,
created by William F. Buckley, a conservative publication. He said, Trump's speeches make his supporters feel good, but so does OxyContin.
Well, Williamson's point, he said, he's very contemptuous of these people. They've kind of a little bit of a conservative elite argument, and it said you have to get up and move and get out of Garbutt, which is a place in upstate New York that I think where gypsum was made at one time, and the factory closed, and it's kind of a desolate place. Yeah, I read his piece, and I actually have suggested to the Clinton campaign that we come out with a mobility tax credit, that a lot of people are in a place that there's just not going to be any jobs, and it's hard for people to move. They have their families, they have their, you know, their whatever, their churches, their organizations. They just grew up there, and somehow or another, we have to give people an incentive. You know, people, our ancestors came from Europe or somewhere else, and then the pioneers went somewhere. I mean, mobility is in my own. I'm not an economist, but we probably have to get more mobility in the economy because there are places that are doing well and some that are doing awfully.
Although there was a study just done and reported this morning that suggested that many of Trump's supporters make good wages, that they are not those angry, underpaid white males that we keep on hearing about, that the Gallup poll has revealed that they, in fact, some of them are paid very well.
Well, some of them are. The bulk of his support, I mean, they're non-college, but the bulk of his support is non-college whites. And if you want something to scare your listeners, non-college whites vote turnout about 53%. College whites, I think, turn out like 78%. So there's a lot of elasticity. If he were able to get that vote really high, he might do better than people think. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's a possibility. And some of these people do well, and there are other grievances they have, but a lot of them don't.
The Republicans control both houses of Congress, a majority of state legislatures, a majority of governors. Why do you think they wound up with such a vulnerable slate of candidates for the presidency?
Well, remember they had 17.
Yeah.
And this was one of the talking about in the book. And 2 years ago, if you were a Republican, you had to be feeling really good. You had just had a big election. You have the deepest bench ever. It's like Obama is not very popular. And then 2 years from now, you're faced with daunting challenges in the Senate. You're behind in the presidential race. Your party is completely fragmented and split apart. There's hardly two formal presidents, presidential nominee, refusing to endorse him, and the Republican Party is in deep trouble. And this was a result of Trump came in and captured the party. He won it.
But Hillary Clinton has also been described as unpopular and vulnerable. What would the Democrats' chances have been against a more conventional Republican candidate?
Well, I have I'll never know, but I wrote a book in 2008 called 40 More Years. And my thesis was that the underlying demographic changes in the United States were really starting to kick in favor of the Democrats. I also think that, as I point out in this book, we've had two successful Democratic presidencies by any measure, by public opinion, by economic performance, by anything else. And in the middle of that, we've had a disastrous Republican presidency by any other measure that you do that. So I'm be totally honest, is I'm deep down inside, I'm kind of glad that they nominated Trump. I think we would have beaten another candidate, but that's supposition. And clearly, from any polling, you'd have to admit that he's about as weak a general election candidate as they could have nominated.
And some people are suggesting the Republican Party might actually wind up disappearing and something else would have to replace it.
It's possible.
The Whigs, perhaps.
It's a 162-year-old party, and right now it's fragmented. But, the Democrats, we're parties go, we're more of a coalition of interest groups. It's going to depend on how much he loses by how he loses. You know, the fashionable opinion is that he's going to start his own television network.
You maintain that the Democrats have better positions on a lot of issues, from Wall Street reform to race relations. But haven't Bernie Sanders supporters argued that Hillary Clinton and many members of the Democratic establishment also have a cozy relationship with Wall Street?
Yeah. I mean, they argue that, and he did better than people thought. But the one thing that I do point out in the book, in terms of performance, there is not even close. Most Democrats don't understand this. In terms of, like, economic performance, in terms of job growth, GDP growth, stock market growth, you name it, Democrats vastly, vastly outperform Republican presidents. And I talked about Professor Alan Blind at Princeton, who put this, all of this information together. You can say, well, maybe the Democrats are just lucky. Maybe the Democrats are, but we are a lot luckier here, and the statistics bear this out. Senator Dodd, Congressman Frank, I mean, certainly they knew people on Wall Street, but all of the predictions about what Dodd-Frank would do to the finance industry has turned out to be completely erroneous. And that's why I talked about Smith and the imposition of liberty and why you have to have some of these regulations.
Well, Obamacare, which has been a success, is now having some problems.
Right.
And there's been complaints that the Democrats haven't really come up with any answers.
The Democrats aren't doing so great either. Right. Well, first of all, Secretary Clinton is for the public option, which would easily address this problem. You could increase subsidies. The problem is that in some states, the number of insurers is pulling out. Now, there's some argument or some evidence that Aetna pulled out because Obama stopped the merger with another insurance company. The solution to the problem is imminently fixable. The Democrats have any number of solutions that are out there. They're not going to pass any of this as long as there's this many Republicans in the Congress. Hopefully, next January, that changes.
Now, Sam Brownback's experiment in Kansas has been a total disaster, his massive tax cuts. Why does trickle-down economic theory still have so much appeal for some Republicans?
I don't know. That is the million-dollar question. Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, was a disaster. You just couldn't imagine the disaster that our governor had to face coming in after this. You know, when Bill Clinton raised taxes in 1993, they said it was going to be an economic disaster. It was the greatest post-war boom that we had. When Bush cut taxes, everybody said the economy is going to really take off. It was the most tepid recovery we ever had. And then when Obama raised taxes on the wealthy again, about the same time he did, job creation, you know, took off. At best, you can say that marginal tax rate on wealthy people has nothing to do with economic growth. You know, you can have causation and correlation, but what clearly has no, and by the way, there's no academic support for trickle down. It's just a political support for it, and that the idea that it stays around is, you know, what Paul Krugman calls it like a cockroach idea. You can't kill it.
We've run out of time, so I can't ask you whether Mary Matlin, your wife, is going to be voting for Trump or somebody else. I know she just re-registered as a Libertarian. The book, We're Still Right, They're Still Wrong, James Carville, thank you so much for being on our show
again. Thank you so much.